I'm a huge believer in serendipity and the impact that it has on people's lives. You know, when you talk about where I am in my life, there are different ways to measure success, and maybe this is something worth talking about. The most obvious index is power and money. And I, you know, I'm not like, the dude or the monk who sold his Ferrari kind of guy. I mean, it is important, let's face it. Okay, so I'm not gonna try and persuade anyone, me least of all. It would be absurdly hypocritical after 17 years as an investment banker from discouraging anyone, Indian or otherwise, from pursuing money. It's a good thing. If you're gonna be an immigrant and you're gonna work your butt off, work 16, 17 hours a day, you might as well get the biggest bang for your buck, right? Biggest or biggest buck for your art, however you want to phrase it. So money is really important. But there again, being an investment banker in the 80s made it a lot easier. If you're an entrepreneur, as a from a failure is a badge of honor. If you failed, then you've learned a little bit of humility. Chances are that if I'm on your board and I'm telling you this may or may not work, you don't have the arrogance of someone who's known only success, effortless success. You're much more likely to listen. So it is, it's not just resilience. It's a little bit of humility. It's a little bit of, kind of willingness to listen to others, to internalize a little bit of what others tell you. It's really, really important. Going to school at the age of 58 to do an MFA, that's radical. And I decided to pursue writing, and I'm pursuing writing with the same vigor that I pursued investment banking when I was 23, with the same sense of excitement.
Welcome to the Indianist Podcast, a show about leaders of Indian origin who have overcome challenges and worked with dedication to ultimately achieve success. By telling the stories of the defining milestones in their journeys, we hope to inspire others to learn how they, too, can succeed in their pursuits. Here's your host, Sanjay Puri.
This is the Indianness Podcast, stories of success from leaders and changemakers of Indian origin. I get asked all the time, why have Indians achieved success across so many different disciplines around the globe? I have no idea, but let's find out together because every story is unique. I'm very excited to have Alok Sama with us today. Alok is a writer, investor, and a board member who's had an incredibly extraordinary journey spanning over 30 years in global finance and other things. He's also the author of the best-selling literary memoir, The Money Trap: Lost Illusions Inside the Tech Bubble. He was formerly president and CFO of SoftBank Group International, where he led some of the most significant deals in tech history, including the $59 billion Sprint-T-Mobile merger and the $34 billion acquisition of Arm Holdings. Right now, he's the senior advisor to Warburg Pincus. But what fascinates me most about Alok is his recent pivot from the world of high finance to creative writing, earning an MFA from NYU, and penning a deeply personal reflection on money, success, and meaning. Welcome, Alok. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on our podcast.
Thank you, Sanjay. Really appreciate the invitation and looking forward to our conversation.
Great. So, Alok, as I had told you before, this is the Indianness Podcast where we really get into the life journeys of change makers like you. It serves as a life story because we don't usually look back dynamic people like you, but also serves as a teaching moment for others who are listening in. So why don't you take us really, really back to where the story began? Where were you born? Tell us about your parents, if there were grandparents and siblings. So just walk us through that journey.
Yeah, sure, Sanjay. Mine is a bit of a classic immigrant story, but I'll rewind. I was born in Delhi for the first 21 years of my life. I think I might have made one trip to Bombay, as it was known at the time, and maybe to Calcutta, but that was the extent of my travels. And my father was a research scientist at the All India Institute of Medical Sciences, and When my parents got married, my mother was a student at the All India Institute of Medical Sciences. In fact, it was, I don't know if you're familiar with AIIMS, it's probably still is, I believe, the premier medical institution in terms of research. It's a teaching hospital in the United States. So that's the environment on the campus of the All India Institute of Medical Sciences that I grew up in. My father was a registrar, then he became an assistant professor and an associate professor, and it's a classic kind of Indian bureaucratic progression, right? I mean, you start off, the salary is nothing, but you move from what is called I-type housing to D-type housing to E-type housing, and you go from like a earliest memories running around with my father. In fact, the whole family had one younger brother in a two-wheeler West Bus scooter, and eventually migrated to a beat up. Some of your listeners might be old enough to remember those beat up old Fiat cars, which became premier cars that used to populate Indian roads in the 70s, 80s. So my father gave up his he was a very successful scientist, awarded the Padma Shri for his contributions to research. He was a gastroenterologist, and later became a private practitioner and chairman of what is still probably the premier charitable hospital in the country, Sir Gangaram Hospital. So that was my background growing up. It was a happy childhood. My parents were nurturing, did all they could for us. We didn't have money, but I think candidly that hurt them more than it hurt me. I mean, I think I could see they wish they could have given us more materially. And so that was my childhood. And I went to a school run by Irish Christian Brothers, a place called St. Columba School, fairly typical kind of colonial institution. They were back then, at least. Now it's all locals, but at least at the time, they were Catholic missionaries, well-intentioned. But it was, I went to St. Stephen's College. I went to Wharton. I went to the MFA at NYU. I have to say, school was the best educational experience I've ever had. And I think what those people did, those Catholic Christian brothers, is kind of instill a sense of discipline. That's where I learned to read, developed my reading habits. I was always a voracious reader. That's where I discovered Dickens, Jane Austen, Shakespeare, the works. And then I was good at maths too. I went to St. Stephen's College, yet another missionary institution founded by missionaries from St. Steve from King's College in Cambridge, in New Delhi. And then accidental meeting with a someone who my father knew was a father. Thought was a mathematician who might be able to help me. I was studying mathematics at St. Stephen's College, and I described this in my book, kind of one of those serendipitous meetings. I mean, I had what did I know about America? If you grew up in India in the 70s and 80s, I mean, there's no television, there's no movies, they censor the heck out of everything. I used to listen to Dylan, I used to listen to Springsteen, and that was kind of, that's how I knew America. And never heard of Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan. Vaguely might have heard of Citibank or Bank of America, perhaps. I mean, those are the only kind of American institutions that operated in what used to be known as the Third World. And this gentleman, as it turned out, was a professor of operations research at the Wharton School. And he encouraged me, helped me, supported my application to go to the Wharton School, and that's how I came to America at the age of 21. And that was fortunate. It was a good time to be in the 80s bull market. I kind of stumbled into Wharton was a very finance-oriented school. I stumbled into the world of finance, and I use the word stumble a lot when I describe my career because it was sort of a mostly a series of mostly serendipitous accidents, and I landed at Morgan Stanley, and started off in New York, and then moved to Asia, set up Morgan Stanley's business in India actually, and then I was in London, kind of had a nice 17-year career. So that's kind of going back, and we could take this any which way you want, but broadly speaking, that's my career. And obviously, I was at SoftBank through some crazy, crazy times, and a lot of that madness is captured in the book I just wrote.
Great. Fantastic. Well, I want to go back again a little
Yep,
bit.
sure.
Your dad was a pretty impressive gentleman, I mean, you're downplaying it, Padma Shri.
Yeah.
He, head of research at Ames. I mean, for people who don't know, Ames, you can put it in the category of Harvard Medical School or MD Anderson or Cleveland Clinic or maybe the best in India. And then he was the head at Sir Gangaram Hospital again, you know, as good as it gets. What was, tell us a little bit, you said it was an average Indian household. Because you ended up in finance in a household of medical research, etc. So I kind of want to understand what was it. Mom also was in the sciences, right?
Yeah, yeah. My mother was a I lost both my parents a few years ago, which I do talk about in my book. And that was for me one of those turning points in life, which I can also talk about. Do talk about that in a lot of detail in my book in a very, very deeply personal way in terms of the expectations my family, my parents, my father in particular had of me. So it was, they were both doctors. And they knew absolutely nothing about finance. And it's interesting, you know, people assumed that I would go into medicine. It's a natural thing. I mean, I think it probably happens on average. Maybe it still does in Indian households more than it does elsewhere in the world. You know, kind of, it's not quite the caste system, but you know what I'm talking about. You know, kind of sons are expected to follow in the footsteps of their fathers. But I had, you know, kind of one or two incidents, one incident in particular that I remember vividly. A group of students, my father's students, I don't know what they had in mind. I was 10 years old at the time. They took me to the morgue. And, you know, in a medical college, in a research hospital, they have all these corpses and they cut them up to study them, right?
The cadavers. And,
the cadavers, exactly. And they get, and you have to get this way to be a doctor, you get pretty callous about looking at bodies or cut up bodies or cadavers. And but for a 10-year-old, I mean, like I said, I don't know what they were thinking, but I was horrified. I was terrified. And I kind of realized, I internalized probably more than I should have, that I was probably too squeamish to be in the medical profession, and that sort of stuck in me. So I never pursued medicine. I ended up studying mathematics in college because it came easy to me. I might have studied English literature because that was writing, reading. That was perhaps my first love. You know, kind of, I was a little bit schizophrenic, right? Yeah, I mean, I was very analytical, but at the same time, I loved to read too. So yeah, that's how I ended up in college. And then, like I said, accidental meeting, and that led me to the United States, to the Wharton School in the world of finance.
Going back to that cadaver moment, would you consider it a little bit of an inflection point? Because maybe if that hadn't happened, things could have gone a little differently.
Yeah, you know, I absolutely. I'm a huge believer in serendipity and the impact that it has on people's lives. And I have very few regrets about things I've done. You can always, you know, kind of super optimize. I should have done this 2 years earlier or 4 years later or whatever, but nobody gets that perfectly right, right? By and large, I don't think I made any horrible mistakes. But as I reflect on my years in the business, and I think it's a little bit patronizing to be advising people, and I try not to do even in my book. I mean, there's nothing in my book about like 7 secrets of leadership or any of that garbage, which I just plain don't believe in. But the one thing I do like to pass on to people is just chill, right? I mean, you cannot make life happen. And in a sense, that's been one of my greatest learnings after 40 years, not just in the world of business, but in life, you know, as a writer, etc. You cannot make life happen. You know, so much is serendipity, being in the right place, being the right time, at the right time. Me joining SoftBank was yet another fortunate accident. One of my closest friends happened to be Indian, Nikesh Arora, right? I describe in the book, Sanjay, you've certainly read that bit, I'm sure, about, you know, how we happened to be on holiday and he had just left Google to join SoftBank. And, you know, again, that was just fortuitous. We happened to be together. We happened to be together on a day where he was struggling with certain financial problems, and he talked to me, and kind of like, okay, this is my buddy, this is my friend, and he seems to be the right guy. And boom, next thing I know, I'm working by his side and I'm hanging out with Mr. So. And then he leaves. Again, yet another, I didn't see that coming. I didn't want to see that happen, but I end up as Mr. So's right-hand man. Again, serendipity, accidents.
Would you call it serendipity? Because I've had a lot of guests like you. Or is that the same thing as luck?
It is. It is. I'm not sure if there's a difference. I mean, look, you never want to underestimate the importance of, you got to have certain basic building blocks, a level of intelligence and a commitment, a dedication to hard work and a basic sense of integrity, dedication, etc. I take those things as a given, and I think I'd like to thank most of the people, most of your listeners will kind of, will have that ethos anyway. Beyond that is, again, it is luck, it is serendipity.
If and I'm going further ahead, and I'm going to bring you back, don't mind. If
Sure, of
you
course.
look back at your life, what percentage of things would you attribute to serendipity or luck versus, the skills and everything else are table stakes, as you said, for you and the listeners here. What, just take a guess.
I'd probably say 70%.
Wow,
I
coming
mean, look,
from
I'll give you
Alok
again. So here's
Samar.
the thing. When you talk about where I am in my life, the different ways to measure success, and maybe this is something worth talking about. The most obvious index is power and money. I'm not like the dude or the monk who sold his Ferrari kind of guy. I mean, it is important, let's face it. Okay, so I'm not going to try and persuade anyone, me least of all. It would be absurdly hypocritical after 17 years as an investment banker from discouraging anyone, Indian or otherwise, from pursuing money. It's a good thing. If you're going to be an immigrant and you're going to work your butt off, work 16, 17 hours a day, you might as well get the biggest bang for your buck, right? Biggest buck for your art, however you want to phrase it. So money is really important. But there again, being an investment banker in the 80s made it a lot easier. Being a senior guy at Morgan Stanley through the internet bubble, I mean, that was great timing. Those are, again, an accident of when I was born and when I happened to be in the business. It would have been very different at other points in life. The part of my life that has probably worked the best, and I meditate every morning. It's a healthy habit, and I try and reflect on the sentiment I try and radiate, I try and channel every morning is gratitude. And probably the thing I'm most grateful for is family. I've been married 39 years.
Wow,
That
congratulations.
is serendipitous or not, that is a decision I made when I was, if you can believe, 22. We got married. I was 23, she was 21. And the way she's grounded me, and we have a wonderful family. And now, we worked at it. We've invested in that relationship with our children. We still do. You can never take it for granted. So that's not luck, but that's the other part of my life that's really worked. And if you want to talk about kind of success and how you define it, that to me has got to be the overwhelming part of it. My health too. Again, I'm fortunate, but I work at it too. So it's a combination, but serendipity, luck plays a huge part of it, right?
Key lesson for our listeners that luck does play a key part. I'm just going to take you back again to Columbus. What was the decision for people who are not from Delhi to go to Columbus, not DPS or some of those other
Oh
rivals?
man, I got a great story for you. I relate this in my book. This is one of those, this is one of those things. I write this in my book, and when my mother passed away, I reflect on, kind of who else would know stories like this about me, right? So my mother had this story which she did not tell me until I was a teenager. So there was another school in Delhi, it was called Modern School. My parents, for whatever reason, were very keen that I go to modern school. And my father, and this is sadly the way India works, you know, it's a lot of it is about who you know. And my father, one of his patients happened to be the lieutenant governor of Delhi, and he kind of recommended me. So I thought that, you know, they thought I would get into modern school, but I was turned down. And the
Even
principal,
with the lieutenant governor?
but hear me out. So my the principal of the school tells my mother was 23 at the time, you know, so just picture this young mother. Sorry, she was 23 when she had me, so she was, you know, she was 27, 28, still very young. He tells them in a typical Indian way, and I'm very sorry, madam, but your son is a little bit retarded. His exact words. So that's how I ended up at St. Columbus School. It was the second choice. By the way,
But she
I'll
told
tell
you that later.
you, she told me that later. You know, I mean, it would have messed with my head if I was 7 or 8 or 10 years old, right? But
Did you ever go back to modern school at
I
some
did.
point in your
Can I tell you something? Here's another
Yes,
great story. So
please.
I used to be a really keen cricketer, and we used to play cricket for the school, and we would play cricket against modern school, and these guys were what, you know, you would call in Punjab total gundas, right? I mean, you know, they would lose a match. They lost a match once, and they beat up the umpire because he gave what they thought was a bad umpiring decision. So again, serendipity, right? I mean, I could have gone to that school, and I might have become a gangster.
There might be modern schools alumni listening to this too.
And hopefully they can laugh about it. I have very close friends from modern school, but it's far enough in history that we can all laugh about it. I mean, look, when I
That's
got into St. Stephen's College, the most prestigious course at St. Stephen's College was not mathematics, which is what I did, was actually economics, right? So my results were fantastic. But St. Stephen's College, because it has the, you know, imprimatur of the church, and they have, you know, minority protection, right? They were the only college that gets to decide to that gets to interview students before admitting them. And I went for my interview, and the principal was this you know, kind of wearing a tie, you know, a legacy of the Raj. Name was, you know, God bless him, he's passed away, I shouldn't speak ill of him, Dr. Rajpal. And he looks at me, and he goes, so tell me, Alok, in a very English accent, who's your hairstylist? I used to have long flowing hairs. I don't know, I thought he was a rock star. So
Well, you're a Bob
without Yeah, well, there you
Dylan
go, right?
fan.
So without batting an eyelid, you know, it was very, with hindsight, it was really cheeky of me. I said, you know, I go to the same stylist as Amitabh Bachchan. I go to the Silhouette Barber Shop at the Oberoi Hotel. So I guess they didn't know what to do with me. Some of them laughed, some of them looked at me like I was nuts, and I didn't get in.
Didn't.
No, I didn't.
Into
So, but you
the
didn't
econ
come.
program.
Then I did the my mathematics interview was they just asked me to solve calculation and 3D geometry problems, which I did in heartbeat. So I got into mathematics. But
So
again, by the way,
you were all for two, by the way, in interviews
but you know
growing up.
the yeah, well, exactly. But you know, here again, serendipity, right? So I studied mathematics. I was really good at mathematics. I ended up, it sounds like I'm blowing my own horn, but it just happens to, you know, kind of come up, but I'll say it. So I was so good at mathematics that I was first in the university. First, being first in the university, and you know, Delhi University, it's like it's across all colleges, not just St. Stephen's College. So you're talking about thousands of people. And
Thousands.
because mathematics, you're talking about, you know, kind of you get the highest marks. So I had the highest aggregate marks in my first year, my second year, my third year, my 3 years put together. And I don't think I would have done that studying economics or any other subject. So that worked out fine too.
That's true. That is
Yeah.
true. Now you were playing cricket at Columbus, right?
Yes. Yeah.
What position were you good at?
So I was lazy. So I used to like I was a batsman. So I would bat at like, you know, kind of either open or number three, and then field in the slips. I didn't like running around.
Do you think that was a good period? You got to meet people, some competitive juices. Do you think sports helps in some of those ways?
Oh, absolutely. It really, really does. I mean, teamwork, team building, how you relate to people. Most importantly, how you deal with failure, right? I mean, it is that's you, the getting out for a duck. I remember I scored three ducks, three in a row. I went through this, and it's really, really traumatic to recover from that. I had to deal with that with my son. My son was a very talented cricketer. And I remember, he was playing at the county cricket level. He did his schooling in England. And I remember, kind of driving him to, there was this one match in Norfolk. He was a batsman like me, but he was an all-rounder. He used to be a fast bowler too. So he's a much better athlete than I ever was. And, you go there and poor kid, he gets out second ball for a duck. It's traumatic. And, but then, that's where that experience comes in and you share experiences and, kind of you work at it. And next time you go out and you score a 50 or whatever, and then like, you become resilient. And that's in the startup world, in the business world, that is so absolutely critical because nobody has it smooth sailing straight down the middle. There's always going to be deviation, always going to happen. You know that. I mean, everyone, kind of it's young people may not know that if they don't. I mean, you just got to know that that's going to happen. It's all about how you recover.
So sports, for listeners who are looking to invest in companies, if your startup entrepreneur has played sports, if he's failed in sports, even better, according to Alok.
Well, if you fail,
Alok?
if you failed as an entrepreneur, even better. Right, because it is.
Okay.
If you're an entrepreneur, as a from a failure is a badge of honor. If you've learned, if you failed, then you've learned a little bit of humility. Chances are that if I'm on your board and I'm telling you this may or may not work, you don't have the arrogance of someone who's known only success, effortless success. You're much more likely to listen. So it is. It's not just resilience. It's a little bit of humility. It's a little bit of, kind of willingness to listen to others, to internalize a little bit of what others tell you. It's really, really important.
So failure equates to humility, which is very, very important. Alok, any friends during Columbus and Stevens that you made?
My closest friends, some of my closest friends are still the people I hung out with when I was in school. And it is a wonderful feeling. We don't WhatsApp each other, we don't like we don't have to talk to each other often, but when we meet, it's as if we've rewound the clock like 30, 40 years. Right. I mean, if
Wow.
my daughter got married last year and I was absolutely insistent that I wanted my friends from school to be there. And I had to explain it to my daughter. It was a very small affair. And I said, sweetheart, you've got to understand this is a very big deal for you. But my daughter getting married is a very important occasion in my life. And I want to share it
Yes.
with friends who don't know you. But you will not appreciate the kind of goodwill they would bring just because you're my daughter. And that's a very, very special bond that I treasure.
That's a great thing. Why is that important? Just explain to our listeners why.
Well, you're
Why is
always
it
going to need.
important to you? Why is it important to you?
Well, it is. You always want friends you can count on, and most importantly, friends who have seen you stripped bare, who knew you when you were absolutely nothing, right? Who was the kid who was always trying to, this nerdy kid who had trouble getting girls or trouble scoring runs in the fourth field, and they were still my friends, you know what I mean? I mean, it
Yeah.
is there's no agenda when I hang out with them. I don't want anything from them. They don't want anything from me. Not to suggest they won't be there for me when I need them, or vice versa, but that feeling is really, really special.
That's a very, very important point.
Yeah.
So, you went to obviously Stevens, you did econ, or sorry, math.
Yeah.
And then, as you have talked about it, you met somebody from Wharton. What did parents, mom and dad, think about you talking about going abroad?
It was they encouraged me. I again, you have to rewind to India in the 1970s, 1980s, which is when I went. everyone who could get out, everyone who could afford to get out, left. Right? I mean, it was, again, a little bit of serendipity. Started in the 1960s after the Civil Rights Act and Hart-Celler, which you'll be familiar with. Before that, immigration to the United States was basically race-based quotas, right? So, you know, kind of late 60s, 70s is when Indian immigrants, the first wave of Indian immigrants, professionals started coming, educated professionals started coming to the U.S. And anyone who could leave left. You look at the medical profession in the United States. My father, when he used to come to the U.S. when he would visit me, the number of his former students who were absolutely creme de la creme, the top doctors at the Mayo Clinic, all the most prestigious medical establishments, even Deepak Chopra, right, who's evolved into something completely unique. Even Deepak Chopra was a student of his at Ames, right? So it was, if you wanted to do anything, certainly make money. I mean, what were you going to do in India? I mean, you know, you needed a license to start like a pawn shop, right? I mean, you know, it was license Raj. You know, you couldn't be an entrepreneur. If you went to work for a company, you know, there were a handful of not very interesting companies, maybe multinationals you could work for. They paid you a pittance, and I'm not sure what you really learned. I mean, they were kind of, you know, very traditional, stodgy British companies. So, yeah, I mean, you know, my father had done a one-year internship in Boston, so he'd seen the U.S., and so they gave me nothing but encouragement. And by that time, my father was, in fact, one of the reasons, you know, kind of debt of gratitude to my parents and my family. My father started his private practice. Part of the reason he did that is because he wanted to make a little bit of money so he could afford to send me and send my brother, which he did, to the United States.
So, brother younger than you?
I have two younger brothers. I have one brother who's 3 years younger, another brother who's 15 years younger. Both in Delhi now, incidentally.
Both in Delhi.
Yeah.
Growing up fairly close.
My younger brother and I, not particularly close. My youngest brother, I left when I was 21. He was 6 at the time. So it was a very different relationship. So we're a tight family overall. My two nieces and my sister-in-law, actually, as we speak, are staying at my home in London, which is lovely. But, you know, that family, extended family, cousins, sisters, that was always very, very, very important to us. Equally, my wife. Her extended family in Delhi, Amritsar, etc.
Any grandparents ever visiting or stuff like that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, my paternal grandfather, I lost fairly early in life. It was the first time I dealt with death up close and personal, died of a heart attack. So he was very strict, you know, kind of very strict disciplinarian. That's my memory of him. And my grandfather, maternal grandfather, very fond memories of him. He was used to work for the ITU, the Indian Telephone Exchange. So he was a civil servant, but in his spare time, his first love was he was a cartoonist. So that's what he used to do, always doodling. Wow. That's what he loved to spend his time on.
R.K. Lakshman.
Yeah, exactly. R.K. Lakshman, yeah. Exactly. That was his inspiration, yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
So, Alok, you met this gentleman from Wharton at Stevens, and he says, why don't you apply?
Yeah.
And you said, okay. You at that time, everybody wanted to get out. You said, hey, let me do that. So you applied to Wharton.
Yeah, I did my GMAT, applied to Wharton, and I was fortunate enough. I know he helped me, but I was fortunate enough to get it.
For MBA program.
Yes. Yeah.
Were there at that time a lot of people going for MBA generally? Was it not for undergrad, engineering, IIT kids going out? What was the wave?
There were the IIT kids doing masters. That was happening a lot. Certainly, if you graduated from IIT, your pathway was to well-trodden. You know, they're running the country, the technology business in the United States right now. It's quite amazing. But it was IIT and then do a master's in, you know, computer science or whatever at the best college you could get into. That would presumably, that would give you money, that would give you scholarship. And equally MBAs. I mean, you get the, you know, kind of the Wharton School was, there's a fairly, even at the time, there was a fairly healthy Indian population.
Yeah. So tell us, you landed from Delhi to Philly, right?
Yes, cultural shock. Yeah. Oh my. Yes.
What time of the year was it?
I describe a little bit of this in the book. It was, you have this, it's not like you get to watch movies like Taxi Driver that expose you to the gritty, edgy side of America, New York, right? I mean, I don't know what to expect, but you land up at, land at JFK and you take an MTA bus to the Port Authority bus terminal. And oh my God, I mean, you see the poverty and you've been trained to, I don't know if we were racist or not, but you'll appreciate this. I'm just going to tell it like it is, kind of both my, as Indians, we were just paranoid of African Americans. We were just taught, somehow conditioned to assume that they were dangerous, which is just a horrible feeling to have, right? And and they were, you were surrounded by these people. There was so much poverty, but more importantly, there was so much hostility. And I'm really sorry to say this. I am anything but a racist, but that's how you. It was really, really intimidating. I mean, I'm just thrown into this, and I was fair game. I felt really, really vulnerable. It was scary. It was really, really scary. West Philadelphia again. I mean, when we were there, there was this movement called, I think it was called Black Panther, which was a African-American fringe group that was only a few blocks away. And the mayor of Philadelphia decided to go to war with them and actually literally flattened a few city blocks. I mean, he had like helicopters coming in, dropping bombs, three blocks away from where I was staying in West Philadelphia. It was very, very scary.
So how did you cope with that? You're a kid, generally fairly protected environment,
yeah.
Right? Mom
yeah.
and dad,
yeah.
Stevens yeah. and Columbus, yes, you get into trouble, but not this kind of trouble.
So no,
Did you feel like running back at some point?
Let me put it this way. No, I didn't feel like running back. I was determined to succeed. There was so much, my parents had invested in my education and, what was I going to go back to, right? There's always this overriding consideration that what am I going to go back to? By that time, I was in a relationship with Maya, who's my wife now, and we both decided that we were going to make a home in the U.S. So I had to kind of stake it out. I had to get a job, and I did what came naturally to me, which is I was a nerd. I just put my head down and kind of buried my head in my books, and I studied hard. It wasn't a particularly partying, happy hours. I have none of those happy associations and memories with business
school.
No, yeah, I had very little of that, to be quite honest. So I managed to get a job and made a life for myself.
How was Wharton academically for you? It little
very
changing
easy.
The way.
Very easy. Stupid easy.
Really?
Again,
for our listeners who think Wharton's like the king of finance.
I have to tell you, look, to be fair, I was academically very, very good analytically. And for me to study finance, I mean, I was, this is difficult to say this without sounding arrogant, but I'll say this anyway, I found myself in class and I would tell the professors, so there's an easier way to solve this problem. And
wow.
And I would do
and
it.
This
because,
is a Wharton,
you know,
this is a Wharton professor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I still vividly remember one or two incidents like this. So finance came easy to me. Part of it was somehow I found that a lot of the people in class, maybe because they'd been out of academia or they didn't want to deal with mathematics, they tried to dumb it down, which I found quite irritating. So I just to challenge myself, I actually did a few PhD courses in game theory, etc. But what was not difficult for me?
Really? So 2 years, basically?
Yeah, it was 2 years, yeah. Okay. By the way, I mean, for anyone who's come from IIT, you've been through those IIT GE entrance exam, and you've been through that, and you come to the Wharton School, I mean, those kids will run circle around. Yeah, not just Americans, everyone. And I don't mean to, by the way, I don't for a minute want to suggest that Indians are in some way smarter than Americans, as you know, as well as I do. The average people are shocked when I quote this statistic, but it is an official statistic. If to the degree you believe IQ measures intelligence, the average IQ in India is only 75, right? So it's not as if like we're genetically smarter than Americans, but there's a sampling there. And but when I came to Morgan Stanley, you know, that was like the creme de la creme of the Ivy Leagues, Harvard Business School, Wharton, Stanford. They were incredibly smart. They were incredibly hardworking. And I had to give it all I had to keep up with them.
You did. So
yeah,
you were,
absolutely,
so to speak, from, and they recruited you from Wharton?
Yeah.
So you were from a, would you say from a small fish, you went to a big pond where there were similar people to you?
Yeah, it's less about size of the pond, but I certainly was way more challenged. I was surrounded by people, many of whom I acknowledge were smarter than I was. Let me put it that way.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So how was the first few years there? I mean, did you enjoy the work there?
I did. I learned a lot. I mean, it's like it wasn't even a learning curve. It was a learning pole, right? So I did. I mean, it was engaging. I did through my years at Morgan Stanley. I did have a tendency. I still do. I tend to get bored very quickly. You know, kind of I thrive on one of the things I've learned about myself. It's I'm driven by intellectual curiosity. Is once I've really understood something, once I've done something, I get bored with it and I want to move on. But Morgan Stanley was wonderful that way. They let me do something different every few years. So I started off in New York, and then I ended up in Asia, right? I mean, I went to Hong Kong. I set up a capital markets business there. I went to India. I set up an investment banking business there. And then I wanted to be in London. I decided that we wanted to really make our family and make our home in London. So they transferred me to London. So it was wonderful that way. I did, by the way, I didn't go. I had an interim stay at Merrill Lynch too. But Morgan Stanley was where, you know, kind of, it's 17 years. That was my mainstay in investment banking.
Wow. We talk in this show a lot about the role of mentors.
Yeah.
Along the way, any mentors that you had, Alok, at Morgan Stanley or before that?
Certainly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was.
Talk about that.
Yeah. When I first joined Morgan Stanley, it was an Indian gentleman, a Bengali gentleman, and he took me under his wing, sponsorship. And then later on, was another seasoned investment banker who I really looked up to as a role model. You know, he was American, but incredibly bright. And you know, to the extent that I started with both these gentlemen, I started copying how they dressed, how they spoke, how they conducted themselves with clients. Because investment banking is an apprenticeship business, right? So all of those softer qualities are really, really important, how they dealt with people, how they dealt with office politics. So yeah, I think mentorship, role models are really, really important.
That's true. That is true. And being in different cities, that was not a challenge. Moving countries with the family, that was not an issue, right?
I wouldn't say it wasn't an issue. It's never easy. Ask my wife that question. She bore the brunt of that. She, when we first were in New York, she was working at the New York Philharmonic. And then after we had our first child, she decided to give up her career, which was a huge compromise for her. And, you know, you have to sometimes wonder whether she should have stuck with it. But certainly from the perspective of the flexibility it gave me, it was terrific. You know, I was able to deal with making moves to Hong Kong, which is quite stressful. I was able to do that thanks to that support.
That's a very good thing. Alok, in terms of when you obviously went on to this journey, you, in your book, you talk a lot, and you know, I've obviously benefited from listening, how you got on to SoftBank. Just tell our listeners briefly, because obviously they can get the longer version if they, you know, get your book. But how do, you know, you talk about serendipity, luck, etc. How did that happen?
Well, it was the chapter
and what are the lessons here?
Yeah, well, there's a chapter in the book where this happens, and the title of the chapter is "I Took a Pill in Ibiza." So, the lesson
Yes,
is
I listened to that.
the lesson is not necessarily to go and pop a pill in Ibiza or anywhere else. but you know, look, I mean, I happen to be on vacation with my friend Nikesh, and it was a fun little trip after he got married, and he had joined, he was the chief business officer at Google, and he just joined SoftBank as a successor to Masayoshi Son, and he needed someone with my background being someone experienced in deal making in the telecom media technology industries, and he brought me on board, and that's how I ended up at SoftBank. And you know, initially as a consultant, because I wasn't convinced this is something I wanted to do at that stage in life. And then I met Masayoshi Son and began to really liked him and admired him, and joined SoftBank full time and loved it, by the way. I mean, those are professionally, those were a few of the happiest. Things started to go, you know, kind of a little bit pear-shaped a little bit later, but the first 2-3 years were professionally some of my happiest years.
So again, for our listeners here, Alok, this was a big sort of change. You know, you were in a traditional, you were in a pretty good slot in Morgan Stanley. You were, it's, you could just keep going up. SoftBank, yes, it is pretty big. It's investment banking. It's got a mercurial CEO who's done exceptionally well. What, again, for lessons for our listeners who are thinking of some big changes to make, did you, what, were there any thoughts or analysis? You're a pretty analytical guy from what you are saying.
But it's funny.
Or is it just Nikesh who said, I need you?
Actually, no. There's not a lot of analysis. I described this in my book, and I don't know if you can take any lessons from this. By the way, I didn't go straight from Morgan Stanley to SoftBank. I had my own business in between, which is a separate story, which was actually an investment business directed in India. But funny enough, the first call, I do talk about this in my book, you might recall this, is the first call I made after Nikesh sort of made me an offer is I called my son. And
really, yes.
You know, he was he had just graduated from, well, actually he hadn't even graduated from college. He was doing a summer internship, and I told him about this, and he was just so enthusiastic. And you know, it is, you have to be a father, you have to be a father to teenage children to appreciate this at some stage in life. Trying to do something that your kids think is cool, it's a very high bar. That becomes a motivator. Yeah. So that in no small measure was one of the reasons I decided to do this. people don't believe this, but it absolutely 100% true. More than the money or the excitement or whatever, at that in the moment, that was one of my motivators.
Why did your son think it was cool? Because they had invested in Yahoo and Alibaba.
No, because he just thought that, you know, Masayoshi Son, this huge deal maker, and you know, he decided banking wasn't for him, but he was briefly at this boutique investment bank called the Rain Group, and he was aware of what SoftBank was doing, and it seemed big, it seemed exciting, it seemed cool, and I could kind of see it from his perspective. And, you know, there's an element of that says, like, okay, you're impressed with all these dudes you're working for. And I guess what? Your dad could run circles around them. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's like.
Wow. Yeah. No analysis, no nothing. No, my son thought it was cool, and I wanted to take a chance and make him kill.
Sometimes life is just not that complicated. These are very, you know, these are base motivations that you react to.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Your base motivations.
Yeah.
Very good point for our listeners.
Yeah.
Nikesh left. Did you think of, and again, I'm basically trying to, you know, again, this is all lessons for our listeners. Did you think of leaving, or you just wanted to stay?
I wanted to, I'm not sure what I wanted to do. I go through this, my thought process in a lot of detail in the book, my feelings. Nikesh is a very close friend, still is, by the way. when he left, kind of the back of my mind was like, okay, what happened? Was he discriminated against racially? Was he wrongly done? But then I talked to Son-san, who I'd become very fond of, Masayoshi-san, and he genuinely wanted me to stay. And I liked him. I was enjoying what I was doing. So I stayed. And by the way, Nikesh encouraged me to stay. I mean, his words were like, you know, look, I mean, I got to do what's right for me. And I still think this makes sense for you. And I know Masa likes you. So you should stay if you want. So I did stay. But it wasn't a given. I had to think about it consciously.
You had to think about it.
Yeah.
Great. You have changed a lot of directions at this stage.
Yeah.
Right? You've done an MFA.
Yeah.
You've written a book. What were the big inflection points? Now, talk about that.
Yeah. So that may well be the biggest inflection of all, because relatively speaking, from banking to the world of investing is you're just doing different kinds of deals with different people. You know, kind of it's actually not that different, to be quite honest, because right. That's why I wasn't, you know, for me, absent the, you know, kind of show my son I'm cool factor, doing working for SoftBank wasn't a big deal. It wasn't a big change. But going to school at the age of 58 to do an MFA, that's radical. And yeah. I'm not talking about, you know, kind of dudes who do an executive MBA program or whatever. That's like, I mean, come on. That's like, you know, this is like being in a classroom with a bunch of 20 somethings doing something you've never done before. You know, we're reading books and we're talking about books and we're writing and we're sharing writing and we're critiquing each other's writings and the typical profile of my classmates. This is NYU, as you can imagine, you know, kind of very, very woke left wing. The typical profile of my fellow students would be mid 20s, female, you know, socialists. You know, I was the great evil with my background.
Yes.
I can, you know, I'm sure you've been following Zoran Mamdani, and I keep thinking of all my classmates and how they would have been, the entire classmates and faculty would have been raging advocates for Zoran. We can talk about that. I can see how they've been posting in social media about it. And you know, hopefully he's good for New York. But to be thrown into that was a pretty radical experience. It's something I wanted to do. I mean, I said, look, if I'm gonna, you know, I'm not gonna go to my grave regretting I didn't do yet another, you know, I don't know, $70 billion deal or meet yet another prime minister or head of state or whatever, been there, done that, but twice over, three times over. I might go to my grave thinking about, you know, a lot of people told me I had a writing voice, you should do this, I got to get this out of my system, right? So, and I didn't go to school with the idea of writing this book. I didn't go with the idea of writing a memoir. I do not read nonfiction books, right? I think most books written by executives are complete garbage. I wouldn't read a book written by someone with my background. I mean that in all honesty, right? So if you, for anyone out there, you know, please don't read my book with the expectation that you're going to learn five lessons in, you know, I don't know, leadership or whatever. It's just not that kind of book. Absolutely not. The only bad reviews I get are people who say, oh, I thought I was going to learn about high-tech finance or whatever. No. There might be some life lessons, but I try not to teach life lessons. The nicest review I got was actually from The Economist, which said that the book is a Rorschach test for readers. You know, kind of what you get out of the book probably tells you something about yourself. You could read it as glorifying the world of finance and deal making, or you could read it as a complete indictment of that world, you know, the vacuousness of that world of chasing money, chasing deals. So it's up to the reader. Hopefully you're entertained along the way. Maybe you learn something along the way. But I wanted to write stories in the book, so I've been told. does read like a story. I mean, there's a narrative arc to it, and that's I
Yep.
want to tell kind of my story. And there's villains along the way, a little bit of sex and violence. There's even a honey trap.
Yes.
So it's just that kind of book. I want to write fiction, and that is what I'm working on now. I think this theme, which you will appreciate this, your listeners will appreciate this. The theme I'm trying to explore in my current book is the Indian immigrant experience in America. And it's not something that's been written about enough. Jhumpa Lahiri writes beautifully. I'm a fan of her work, but she's written about a different type of immigrant, right? It is mostly academics, middle class, centered around the greater Boston area. Again, I don't mean that as a put down. I'm a huge fan and admirer of her work, and I've learned so much from her. But it's very different, and I want to explore Indians in the, and I do a little bit in my memoir, but I want to dig a little bit deeper in terms of identity and other issues with Indians in the United States, in positions of power in the world of, in Wall Street, in Silicon Valley. And I don't want to, it's a critical look because a lot of them go horribly wrong. I mean, a disproportionate number of Indians on Wall Street turn out to be white collar criminals. Some of the more notorious, Rajat Gupta tops the list of white collar criminal cases, happen to be Indian immigrants. And that's a little bit sad, but I mean, those are some of the themes that I want to try and explore. Why does that happen?
So it's going to be a piece of fiction, though.
It's fiction, yeah.
Okay. Wow. So really, but is this something you've been wanting to do for a while? Or is
Yes.
it just
Yeah, I might have done
it's
this when I was a kid, but you grow up and it's comical. I go back and look at St. Stephen's College, the English literature, that class was, I want to say, it was 95% female, maybe even 100%. It was like, and it's in India back then, still is, but much less so. Certainly at the time in the 80s, it was a completely patriarchal society, right? If you were a
Yeah.
man, you couldn't become an artist or become a writer. You were expected to go out and make a living, right?
Yeah.
So it just wasn't even on the menu to go out and do something like study English literature or like, make art or write books. It just never even occurred to me. It wasn't an option, but it's something I did want to do.
And what does your family think of this choice?
Yeah, I mean, they kind of think it's cool, but it's easy for them to say, already provided for them, right? They're not making any compromises.
Compromise. They're saying you do what you want now.
Yeah,
No, but that's
exactly. Exactly.
yeah.
Yeah. You know what me? I mean, I've kind of, been through, the finest schooling, colleges, et cetera, I've given them a start in life. So I don't, kind of, they'll always have my love. I'm always there for them. But at least financially, I don't feel I owe them anything. I want to, indulge what I want to do.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Alok, just we've covered a lot. We talked about some of your key inflection points. We talked about going to, not getting into Morton, getting into Columbus, meeting the person from Wharton. That was a inflection point, luck, serendipity, whatever you want to use. And then obviously getting into Morgan and the experience of getting into this. Are there any inflection points, because we use this as learning, things that we have missed that you would like to bring to attention?
Well, I again, we talked about it, but you missed the biggest inflection point, which is, and it's something for people to reflect on. I'm always very hesitant because I think it's patronizing to be teaching, but the one thing you could take away from my experience in terms of inflection point, and this one wasn't luck, it wasn't serendipity, it was a very deliberate choice, which is, I decided to pursue writing, and I'm pursuing writing with the same vigor that I pursued investment banking when I was 23, with the same sense of excitement. And the one thing I'd like to pass on is, those things, those types of changes are not easy to do. And they only happen when they happen at natural inflection points. So I'll give you, I'll get very specific. So I left SoftBank at a time when there was this smear campaign. Someone was trying to blackmail me, bully me into leaving SoftBank. My friend, former colleague Nikesh was going through the same. And strategically, there were a lot of things going on at SoftBank I wasn't necessarily completely aligned with. So I was in a situation where I was re-examining my life. So it was a natural inflection point. So I said, okay, here's an opportunity to rethink my life. I could have stayed, still made a lot of money. I could have gone to a different shop, but I said, okay, here's an opportunity to step back, reflect, where are you in your life? Should you be doing something different? And the one thing I'd like to pass on, everyone has those moments, right? You lose your job, you have a child, you get married, whatever. In my case, it actually happened to be both my parents passing away, right? Within a very short period of time, forces you to re-examine your life. Think about your mortality. You know, you're 57, 58, you know, kind of what are the regrets you're going to have when you're going to be lying on your deathbed. So when you have opportunities, inflection points, really dig deep, you know, kind of, is there a radical switch you should be making and take advantage of those points? There's opportunities in every crisis, I guess is the best way to summarize.
Opportunities in every crisis. So you made some very important points. One is, this MFA, this book writing is not a hobby. You're pursuing it like you
absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. And I made that decision. I was able to make that switch because I was at an inflection point where I was in a stage in life where a lot had happened in my personal life. I'd lost both my parents. I was really unhappy in my job because of what was happening with the smear campaign, etc. And I said, okay, look, time to reassess, time to reevaluate, right? And the answer that worked for me was not the obvious one, which is go find another job that pays as much money or more money. It was no, do something radically different. Something you want to get out of your system, something that might give you joy, et cetera, et cetera.
So grab an opportunity when it comes to you, even if it's result of a crisis is what you're kind of saying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's a very important lesson. Look, one thing I want to talk about, because you alluded to it a couple of times and I should have, my apologies to the, when your parents, you said passed away close to each other, someone was had that happen. What happened? What went through you? Were you pretty close to your parents?
Well, the sad answer is, talk about regrets. I talk about this very openly. It was very cathartic for me to talk about is, I feel I wasn't as good a son as I should have been. I give this example of, you know, my mother's friends, my mother's brother would tell me how much joy it gave her every time I called, which sounds like a really nice thing to say, except I didn't call as often as I should have. And sometimes when I reflect on, you know, what lessons do you want to give? My book's been amazingly well received in India. And I've interacted with a lot of young people, and inevitably they want lessons, and they're very surprised when I give, to the extent that I'm put on the spot and forced to give advice. It's not about, like, you know, become an investor or use discounted cash flow or become a value investor. I just end up saying, you know, dude, just call your mother more often, right? I mean, it's it was quite profound. You know, you kind of reflect on, you know, my father on his deathbed hugs me. It's probably the last coherent thing he said to anyone, was he just told me how proud he was of me. And then you reflect and say, okay, what have I done that he's so proud of, right? Is it do a lot of deals, make a lot of money? It's that kind of internal reflection, introspection that I went through, and that led me to think about, you know, what do I want to do next?
Well, so spend, obviously you have regrets that you could have comparatively spent more time with your parents. And they were in Delhi when they passed?
Yeah, they were. And, you know, I, again, this is like you leave India at And I know it's a lot easier now that a lot of your listeners are probably most of them a lot younger, so they will not appreciate this. But you go to the US at age 21, and you don't have a lot of, kind of frivolous spending money. There's no social media, there's no internet. Yeah, it used to cost us $3.50 a minute to use call India on AT&T. You couldn't do it. You couldn't communicate, right? The mail was notoriously unreliable. You just disconnect, and that was kind of a price that a lot of immigrants paid, and kind of a lot of them assimilate. And this is what I mean about trying to capture that Indian immigrant experience in my writing. That is tough to deal with. And maybe that explains part of why you drift a little bit away. You just have to make an extra effort to reconnect with family, and particularly.
Reconnect with family, but you do reconnect with your friends, as you said. You pick up right where you left off
We do now,
with family.
we do,
Now, at some point, you were stationed in India for a while, right?
I did, 1994, set up Morgan Stanley's business in India, which is a lot of fun, very exciting for me from a professional perspective.
Wonderful. Alok, obviously, there are some fantastic lessons that you told me and told our listeners. When you look back at your journey, has the, and I think it has, so I'm kind of on the definition of success, has that changed over a period of time for you right now than it was before?
Yeah, of course it has. We've talked about it, but when you come to the US as an immigrant, you measure success in terms of power and money. And if you end up on Wall Street in particular, which I did, again, happened to be in America in the 80s, in a bull market, at a very finance-oriented school, at the Wharton School, and that's how I ended up there. I was thrown into it. And in that world, certainly success is measured in terms of money, and money gives you power, and that becomes your definition. It's the way you keep score, and it's never the amount of money you're making. It's whether or not you're making money, more money than the next guy, than the next Indian or the next American, probably even more than next Indian, right? I mean, it's a very unhealthy competitive dynamic relationship. And I'm so happy to get away from it. That's a little bit of what I mean by the money trap. I see too many people, even people of my vintage, still caught up on it. That is a horrible way to, it's certainly not a path to happiness. And I do talk about this in my book, and people often ask me, look, why do you have to talk about private jets? I do talk about flying private, by the way, and it's wonderful. I recommend it to anyone. Most people who dump on private travel probably haven't done it. It is very cool. But here's the thing, as cool as it is, the people who are flying private, are they kind of, thanking their stars, I'm so happy to be there? No. You're flying a G5, and you're saying, okay, the guy, my boss has a G6, and now it's a G7, right? I mean, it's always a faster plane. And that's what I mean by the money trap. It's nasty, and I'm just so happy to be removed from it. And I still am surrounded by people who are caught up in it. So yes, my definitions have changed quite radically.
Alok, just briefly, if you were to name one person in your life journey that's been the, has had the most influence, one, I have a feeling who it is, but just if you were to pick on one person who's had the most influence.
Oh, for me, it's very easy. It's my wife. She's just kept me grounded,
Maya.
literally. Yeah, she's kept me grounded. Also, I mean, we've been married 39 years, right? So it is sometimes shudder to think of what I might have become if it hadn't been for her. I'd have been, you know that book, American Psycho? I might have become the Indian Psycho.
Oh, God. Well, your next book is definitely going to have a big humor touch to it too, because that's what it should be. That should be. Alok, we ask all our guests, or What is your definition of Indianness? This podcast, this organization is Indianness. What is your definition?
I think the concept of Indianness is highly overrated. I don't even know what that means, to be quite honest. I mean, I think it's fair to say that as Indians, we are more likely to be spiritual and probably less likely to be physical. And that's the extent to which I want to go out. I don't think we're smarter. I don't think we have higher standards of integrity or ethics than Americans or anyone else. I don't buy a lot of that stuff. But most importantly, we're not homogenous. The India I know is just so incredibly diverse. You know this. I mean, you know, it's like if you're from, you come from Amritsar and you're with someone from Kerala, you know, you don't even speak the same language, right? I mean, you know, you communicate in English. So it is that notion of you look different, right? I mean, you know, it is so I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I think my book has been described as a love letter to India. You know, the affection, my love for India, it kind of comes through loud and clear. It's the one place I go to, Delhi, that is, where I instantly feel completely at home. But I have to believe that someone who's grown up in Cleveland, Ohio, probably feels the same way. I'm giving you an incomplete answer, but that's probably the best I could do.
No worries.
Yeah.
At the end, because we live in a TikTok generation, we do this lightning round of questions. Just give me one word answers, okay?
Yeah.
These are fun stuff.
Yeah.
New York or London?
London.
Deal making or writing?
Writing.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee. Change, by the way. It used to be tea, now it's coffee.
Coffee. Okay. This one could be an interesting one. Morgan Stanley or SoftBank?
Ooh. That's a good one. That's a good one.
I knew this was something.
I love Masayoshi Son, but I'd have to pick Morgan Stanley.
Morgan Stanley. Okay. Now I'm going to throw another tricky one at you. Modern or DPS? I didn't put Columbus because that would have been easy for you.
DPS.
DPS. All the modern. Well, he hates modern anyway.
I don't hate modern, but I know some really bright people from DPS, so I guess I'd give the nod to DPS.
Okay. Well, so I wanted to basically, Alok, for our listeners, really, you know, thank you really for sharing such an incredible journey that you had from, you know, the deal rooms of Morgan and SoftBank to the your creative classrooms of NYU. Your story is really a true testament to the power of, you know, self-learning, self-reflection and evolution. And your book, and I hope all the listeners who are, you know, watching this will take a chance to watch or listen to his book, The Money Trap. It really offers some invaluable insights, not just about the technology world, but really about the human condition and our relationship with success. And, you know, for our listeners, Alok's story reminds us that true success might not always be what we initially set out to achieve, and that it's never too late to pursue meaning and authenticity in our work and lives. And that's really Alok's story. And
that's very Alok, well said, Sanjay. Thank you for doing that, by the way. You summarized it really well at the end. Thank you. I could not have said it any better. I'm going to remember that.
Alok, tell our listeners where they can find your book, please.
Oh, my book, Amazon's the easiest way. I hate to promote big tech, but that's probably the easiest way. It should be available at any bookstore, certainly in the US and everywhere in the world. But thank you. Yeah. And I'm also reachable on, I'm on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'm on social media and love to hear from people.
Awesome. Thank you again, Alok, for being with us on the Indianness podcast. To our listeners, keep celebrating your journeys, keep pushing boundaries, and remember, your story is unique, including yours. Thank you so much. Take care. Bye.
Thank you.